Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and call to order the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being here. For those who are following along with our agenda, the first item of business we have is work session, possible introduction of committee bills. We will be doing that tomorrow. We're going to wait until we get a set together and we have everything ready to be able to explain to the members. So the rest of the agenda is pretty much as is. We will be starting off in an informational meeting with an overview from the Department of Justice. So I will open a informational hearing for that purpose. And Aaron, thank you very much for being here, and please bring whoever else you might want with you, if anyone.
Me.
All righty, going solo.
I brought my written remarks here in a binder. So
did we tell him how much time he has or not?
He has no time.
He has no time, okay.
Thank you.
Certainly not that much time, Aaron, I don't think so.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, here to provide a basic overview of the essential functions of that department. Let me start by saying that, like any state agency with an elected official at the head, there's the portion that has to do with any administration as it comes and goes, and then there's the portion that sort of stays constant over the years. So the Attorney General, him or herself, is basically administers and floats over what is functionally the largest law firm in the state of Oregon. We are, and by a fairly significant margin. She is empowered to make major decisions about settlement, about when we join amicus briefs, when we join multi-state litigation, which is a special function that you see nationally of offices of the Attorney General, where basically a group of states will get together and say, hey, we all have the same problem, and collectivize those efforts.
Amicus?
Amicus. An amicus brief is basically, it's friend of the court brief. It's when you're not a direct party to an action, but you believe that you have some stake in it, which for the states is frequent.
Our new members do not understand that. At the end of the session, I will be giving a test, so I want to make certain they know what these different terms are so they can get their pseudo-license.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm just glad I remembered what amicus meant. And so underneath the Attorney General, and that's a very small office with a few specialists, we have a civil rights director, we have a specialist in elder outreach who specializes in elder abuse because that is becoming the issue for attorneys general nationally. It's coming up everywhere. But then underneath that, you have this much larger sort of segmented state agency, which stays more or less constant. So I'll give a flyover version of some of those basic functions and then take any questions. And I think this binder probably has all the answers, which is why it's here. First of all, our appellate division. So almost all of the Attorney General's basic powers stem from Chapter 180. In some states, the Attorney General is a constitutional office. It's and can't be changed without a vote of the people. Here, it's purely statutory. And the most basic function we have is to be the lawyers of the state of Oregon. And that sounds very simple, but it's in fact quite complicated. So our appellate division, for example. Whenever there's a criminal conviction that goes up on appeal initiated by a prosecutor, and there's some legal question, we step in on the appellate level. Now, we weren't the trial attorneys, that was the district attorney, but we handle it as it goes up to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And we do that for every appellate action in which the state is a party. This includes civil cases, administrative cases. The head of that is the Solicitor General. And we also defend the integrity of criminal convictions themselves that way, you know, just making sure that process was followed going from the trial level all the way up to the Supreme Court. Our largest component is the Division of Child Support. And while it has the overwhelming majority of our employees, it has a smaller percentage of lawyers. The Department of Child Support is in charge of collections, and this is a huge job. I've been told by our director of child support that we move over $1 million a day in child in basically delinquent payments for child care. So all of the actions against parents who aren't paying, all of the maintenance of that bureaucracy goes goes through this system. We usually collect somewhere between $350 million and $400 million annually. Up until very recently, we were going through this process with computers that I recognized from my childhood. They had the green cursors and, you know, I used them to play mostly Pong, but we used them for child support. And again, thank you to the legislature. Over the last few biennia, we have phased in an IT project which, against all expectations, is on time and moving forward. So that's a check in the box of state IT actually seeming to work, and are in the process of implementing a new system, which is great news, because if that system had ever crashed, it would become chaotic at the tune of $1 million a day. Our civil enforcement division is responsible for the enforcement of civil law, and this is where a lot of the legislative rubber hits the road. When you ask the Department of Justice to do something in terms of consumer protection, this is usually where it lands. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act is usually, but not always, the mechanism that the legislature selects for us to use to engage in enforcement. Point I always have to make about the UTPA, as it's abbreviated. It has a public right of action and a private right of action. Sometimes you see both of those, sometimes you only see one. So whenever I get the chance to mention the UTPA, I like to remind the legislature that not all UTPA is equal. Sometimes when you pass a UTPA bill or a UTPA expansion, you designate that that is basically the state and a private citizen who obtains counsel who can proceed on their own behalf. The rest of the time, it's the state. Now, when we do it, the standard is a little bit different. It's not enough to just come in and say, I've been aggrieved, state of Oregon, come in and be my lawyer. We can't represent anyone but the state of Oregon. If you're the one harmed, you generally need private counsel, and we can't form an attorney-client relationship with you. So what we look for is something called a pattern or practice of behavior. Basically, you start seeing an individual or a company violating the law in the same way over and over and over again, so much so that the Department of Justice can sit back and say, okay, this is something that affects all Oregonians. This isn't just a disagreement between one citizen and another citizen or another business. This is something that really affects all of us. And at that point, we step in. Now, that does not mean that we're unable to obtain money awards for people that are harmed, similar to the restitution system in criminal law, where you'll see a prosecutor come forward and they're arguing on behalf of the state, but the restitution award ultimately goes back to the victim. With our civil division, it's the same basic mechanism. We can obtain damages, and then we can return those damages back to a citizen or citizens who are harmed. In addition, our civil enforcement division provides legal advice to the child support division, which, as I'm sure you can imagine, is a big job. We house the charitable activities section, which specializes in nonprofits. We receive, every time a nonprofit registers or makes an annual update in the state of Oregon, they're required to by law, a Form 990, it kicks back to our charitable activities division. And so we keep a database of all charities. You may have seen us issue a list annually of the top 10 worst charities active in Oregon. How we know what those charities are is that we can use this database to see, okay, how much did this charity take in and how much did they actually pay out to a charitable purpose, which is the metric we usually use to track how charities are going. Now, and my charities director always likes me to emphasize that when most charities fall out of alignment with state law, they do so by accident. Many charities are small. They might just be a mom-and-pop operation with big hearts and a good idea, but not a lot of technical savvy about how to navigate tax regulations or other state law. So what we usually start with, in the absence of the same thing, a sort of pattern or practice of bad behavior, is a letter. We just say, hey, this is the law. This is how we think you could comply with it. It would be great for everybody if you did that. And our compliance rate is very, very high. In fact, as a general matter, when engaged in civil enforcement actions, we very rarely we do it enough, I think, that it matters, but relative to how many cases we actually take in, very few of them go to trial, and many of them we can correct just by sending a letter and saying, maybe you didn't mean to do this, but you're in violation of law. The primary mechanism by which we take in these cases is a consumer complaint hotline. And many of you are very good about directing your constituents to this hotline or to the Department of Justice, which we appreciate. The process goes like this. We receive thousands of these calls in a database that's staffed. So when you call, you get to talk to a real person. And they'll take down your information, ask you appropriate questions. They're trained to do so. And then they'll do an intake evaluation about where should this case go. If it's appropriate for the Department of Justice, it'll go there. We have good relationships with other agencies, so we can kick them out as necessary. And then it sort of moves up the chain. A lot of these cases are, as I said, resolved informally. It's just a misunderstanding or something else that falls well short of the need to actually have the Department of Justice file a case. But every so often, you start seeing that pattern or practice, and the upside of this database is, you know, we get a call from Pendleton, we get a call from Tillamook, and they're having the same problem with the same business. We can connect those dots much easily than a county or municipal level actor could. And so we see those patterns emerging because we have a statewide reach. So our case resolution levels are consistently very high. The feedback we get from the individuals who call in is consistently very satisfied. And we are proud of our ability to resolve those cases and appreciate your willingness to continue sending them to us. So I hope you'll keep doing that going forward. Another specialized unit that I want to highlight here is the Medicaid Fraud Unit within the Civil Enforcement Division. As I said earlier, fraud against the elderly is becoming an extremely significant problem for the Department of Justice, for the federal government, and for prosecutors. And one of those plays out with Medicaid fraud. And so we've partnered, the federal government will pay for a Medicaid fraud unit. We've seized on that opportunity, and so there's significant federal money that props this up. The reason I talk about it here is because it's one of the only, what I'll call full service bodies that I've seen that can initiate a civil action, an administrative action, or a criminal action, depending on what is most necessary. We can investigate all of those. And that's useful here because you can see licensing problems. You can see organizations that are taking advantage of Medicaid regulations to basically bill in a way that they're not supposed to. The answer to that can be an administrative action, can be a civil action, something injunctive, or depending on how far it goes, it can be criminal. And usually those three don't communicate well. You've got prosecutors who do purely criminal, you've got civil practitioners, and then you've got agencies, and they don't always talk. So this is a nice example of them coming together.
Senator Cruz?
Yes.
You said Medicaid. Can you do Medicare as well?
I am not 100% sure. I could either consult my handy dictionary or I could follow up with you separately.
I would think, I mean, we're talking about elder abuse. We would see some in there. I guess what I would be looking for is if the funding you're getting from the feds would allow you to investigate Medicare as well without a violation.
Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, good question. I'm happy to track it down. Moving on to our criminal justice division. Because we are created the way we are as a statutory office, we only have the jurisdiction that we are given by the legislature. And this is so important that I want to say it twice. We only have the jurisdiction given to us by the legislature. This means that we cannot come in on an enforcement action unless there's a specific statutory provision that allows us to do so. On one level, we're sort of like vampires. If you invite us into the house, we can come in. Otherwise, we can't. How that plays out with the Criminal Justice Division is we have no de facto jurisdiction over prosecutors, and we're not looking for it. There are a few areas where you've given us special authorization to come in and do something sort of without regard to what the DA may or may not be doing. The biggest one, and this is one that makes sense, is public corruption type cases where it might involve a county level official. It could, and this is for obvious reasons very rare, but it could even involve a DA. So at that point, you need somebody who can come in arm's length. But in the overwhelming majority of cases, we work cooperatively and collaboratively with sitting district attorneys. We usually come in because a county is experiencing a case type that they're having trouble handling on their own. This can happen for a couple of different reasons. Imagine if you're a pretty small, and at this point we have many of them, cash-strapped on public safety county. You run a very lean office, you have very few sheriffs, and all of a sudden you get hit just because it happens with two or three murders in a row. You might be able to deal with that first one, but the next two will get you into trouble. And when a defendant is indicted, that starts a clock, and you can't just go in and say, listen, the county doesn't have the resources to deal with this case in an expeditious manner, especially if the defendant's in custody. You need to get going. And so we have that relationship with district attorneys where they will call us and they'll say, Department of Justice, we need some help. Another one that is ticking way up, murders were the historical biggie, but a murder can be and often is less complicated for a prosecutor than this huge wave of financial cases that have been coming in, many of which are online, and you're talking multiple subpoenas and search warrants to try and trace some thread from an IP address on the internet back to a person who took deliberate steps to hide where they were, pages and pages of bank records, and a high level of technical expertise that's needed. So we offer investigative support where we can actually farm out some investigators to help you set up your case, and we offer prosecutorial support. We also have several state specialists. We have one for DUII and one for domestic violence. I used to be a prosecutor for Multnomah County. I had the felony DUII assignment for a while, and I remember calling DOJ's DUII expert in a panic at 11:30 because I'd screwed up a motion to suppress in a way that I'd only just realized and didn't know the answer, and she got back to me by midnight. And they are on the job 24 hours a day. They do statewide trainings yearly and when needed, and they are absolutely the experts in the rapidly changing case law around DUII and domestic violence. One dream I know the Attorney General has is to take a look at doing this with elder abuse for the reasons I mentioned earlier. It's another one of those hyper-technical, very fast-changing issues. But I think most DAs who come up in the state of Oregon will have the experience of calling one of those substantive experts at DOJ. They work very, very closely with local prosecution. We also have the ICAC, which is the Internet Crimes Against Children program. Thousands, if not tens of thousands, of tips about child abuse, child pornography on the Internet come in. And they're time sensitive. If child pornography pops up at a demonstrated location on the Internet, it won't stay there long. And so when we get a tip that it exists, we have to act quickly to investigate it, assign investigators, push it out to district attorneys. So that's what ICAC does. We also have the Titan Fusion Center, which works with the federal government to identify terrorism-level threats and push that back to state actors. That's a conversation that goes both up and down. So if we, as state officials, are hearing that there's something that could constitute a terrorist threat, we can push it up via that mechanism. And if our colleagues at the federal government and within federal intelligence are hearing that something may be coming Oregon's way, this is how we're notified. So it's a valuable, quick sort of red alert device to keep us notified.
Sure.
Senator Cruz.
I mean, the internet is a fascinating area to get into in jurisdiction, and I just received a couple emails complaining that Facebook's protocols weren't sufficient enough to keep some things off that shouldn't be. I haven't seen that personally. But let's say you get something like that and there's complaints against Facebook that they're having inappropriate activity. How would your interaction with something that's multinational be? I mean, how do you interact with something like that?
Sure. Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz. Hard to generalize completely because it can come in a lot of different ways. So here's what I think is typical. If the state of Oregon, for example, was hearing from consumers and constituents or just seeing on our own that a certain type of information that we considered private to be in a way that was in violation of law was coming up through their filters, really what we end up doing for those really big cases is talking to other states. And if you start getting a critical mass of concerned attorneys general, one of them will initiate a multi-state investigation where basically one state is or a handful of states becomes the lead state, and they send out civil investigative demands and other forms of discovery to build a civil case. Usually it is civil here if it involves a big company like Google or Facebook. And then other states will come together as they're interested and enter into a collective action, which then can result in settlement or it can result in trial in that given state. And tobacco is a good example of this, the big multi-state agreements on tobacco. That was states banding together because they were all encountering a common health problem with tobacco products. So I think that's probably most typically how that would be handled.
Yeah. I would also suggest, I mean, some of these really weird things on the internet are coming from Ghana or someplace in Africa, and there's probably not much you can do about that, is there?
Chair Prezansky, Senator Cruz, that kind of a fact pattern where it lands in Ghana, it's very hard.
Yeah.
It's for obvious, for so many reasons I won't even list them. Moving on. Our Crime Victim Services Division. So Crime Victim Services, when we move forward with the Victims Bill of Rights and similar legislation, the need for a state agency that specialized in making sure that the rights that we had given these victims, not just as a legislature, but as a populace, were actually being effectuated. And there's a lot of money and a lot of programs out there that are concerned with crime victims. And the legislature made a decision to create one entity that would sort of operate as the primary pass-through and primary monitor of how this money worked. And to give you just a few examples, and I'll go into these in more detail if you're curious, victims assistance programs, Victims of Crime Act assistance or VOCA programs, Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services programs, also known as ODSVS, Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Programs, CAMI, and Violence Against Women Sexual Assault Services, or VAWA grants, all run through Crime Victim Services. And we advocate for these both in this building and elsewhere. We work with community and service partners. We work with DAs to make sure that not just that funding levels are sufficient, but that the policy issues that require this funding in the first place are being addressed. We also host the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. The Crime Victims Compensation Fund is the only money that will be available to you prior to an award of restitution if you suffer from certain kinds of crimes. And of course, we don't pay out everything that comes in. We can't afford to do so, though I'll note that some states do. What we do is if you suffer a grievous injury, if there's a funeral expense, if you need emergency counseling, other things like that, we will pay out up front if you make a claim so that you don't have to rely on restitution, which doesn't come until sentencing and then depends on a defendant's ability to pay. And for some of these things, it just can't wait that long. This fund is paid for by punitive damages. That is a funding type that has been in decline for reasons that I'll explain if anyone really wants to hear, but the short version is this fund, absent legislative action, is expected to be insolvent by 2016. It's in the governor's budget, not essentially a judiciary issue. Principally, it'll be a ways and means thing, but just highlighting it. CVSD is also, you're going to see them test. I came in yesterday to House Judiciary on behalf of a bill on behalf of CVSD. They're very involved in policy in the building, so you'll see them. Almost done. Two more quick ones. First of all, general counsel. So I said up front, we're the lawyers for the state of Oregon. That includes every single one of their agencies, from the Department of Human Services all the way down to the Blueberry Commission. If you have a legal problem, we will provide you with counsel. And this is all sorts of stuff. This is anything that I would call day-to-day advice just to get by. So if you're promulgating administrative rules, that's DOJ talking to an agency. If you can't figure out what the heck the House Judiciary or Senate Judiciary Committees meant when they issued a certain law, that, again, would be agency-attorney discussion. Now, these attorneys, and this is a question I get a lot, these attorneys work for DOJ, they're trained by DOJ, they're administered by DOJ, they're paid by DOJ, and they're accountable to DOJ, but they have an attorney-client relationship with their agencies. So sometimes somebody will haul me in and say, well, what's the agency attorney bring them in and have them explain this thing. And I can't have them give, I guess, unqualified answers because of attorney-client privilege. So I just ask all legislators to keep that in mind, that the privilege sometimes doesn't even go to DOJ or to the state of Oregon. It'll go to an agency. Finally, the trial division defends the states, its agencies, employees, elected and appointed officials in civil litigation when that happens. We also defend district attorneys if they find themselves to be the subject of civil suits. Civil litigation, torts, employment, commercial disputes, very much traditional law firm stuff, but all done back to the state of Oregon. And this is the division that turns up when it actually does go sour enough that we find ourselves, excuse me, in a trial disposition or when we are the ones being sued. So that's a very quick flyover. I'm mindful of your time and happy to answer any questions now or later. So,
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Actually, I think we had a discussion about this at some point in my office, but how normal, you were talking about DAs, county DAs, and that you don't very often get involved. What is normal among states as far as, for lack of a better term, oversight of DAs? If there's a problem that's surfacing with a particular county or DA's office, what would trigger an investigation or involvement from your office or the AG's office?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, so DAs are county actors, obviously. So they're accountable first and foremost to county commissioners and the citizens of that county.
Independent elected.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so we have no de facto jurisdiction over them. The jurisdiction we would have over a district attorney is actually the same jurisdiction we would have over any of you, which is if you used your position for personal gain or in some other way that constituted legal impropriety, we would have that basis to initiate an investigation. But in terms of if we just disagreed with a DA's charging decision or a sentencing recommendation or what cases they were and were not prosecuting, that is typically not an issue for the Department of Justice.
And follow up, I guess I was just wondering what's normal, is that normal among the states as far as the relationship between the AG's offices and their, you know, the respective DAs?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I'm not an expert and I haven't done an overview, but every state I've run into, that is the dynamic.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would think that unless the district attorney is appointed, they would be similar to our model because as an independent elected official, they're accountable to the people that voted them. Now, I forget the individual district attorney that had some problems. She was, I can't remember if it was Washington, it wasn't Washington County. She was there.
Chair Przanski, I don't remember the name either.
Yeah, but we've had situations in this state in the last probably 15 years ago, thereabouts, where an individual that was an elected district attorney was brought up on charges on some stuff.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions? Aaron, thank you very much. Are you going to be presenting on the bill that we have?
I am. Should I just
stay
here?
There.
Okay.
Any other questions for Aaron on the overview for the Department of Justice? If not, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. Shana?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 189 comes from the Department of Justice, the Attorney General. It deals with mediation and rules about mediation confidentiality. Currently, the Attorney General develops model rules for confidentiality of mediation agreements. This would streamline the procedure for agencies for adopting those model rules.
Wonderful. Whoever is going to proceed, let us.
All right. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Aaron Knott, Legislative Director for the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, here in support of Senate Bill 189. This, as you might gather from when we're bringing it to you, is what we would characterize as a technical fix. And as far as we know, there's no opposition to this bill, and there is a fair amount of support for it. Basically, and I'm going to introduce the smart person here momentarily, but basically what this bill is seeking to do is eliminate a procedural requirement that in the view of the Department of Justice is just not doing any good. With model rules for confidential mediation, in 1997 when you put this together to empower us to do this in the first place, you said, Attorney General, you're the custodian of these rules, and you should be the ones that continue to move them forward. And so agencies can adopt the rules that we put out, but that's it. And what I think was probably the oversight at the time and the friction that's giving rise to this bill is that if agencies want to adopt our model rules, they have to go through a formal rulemaking process. But our rules are the only rules you're going to get. So sitting to my left is Amy Alpa. She is a senior AAG in our general counsel division and my certified smart person. So I'll turn it over to her.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Amy Alpa. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice, and I'm the attorney general opinions coordinator, and I advise on administrative law frequently. Not to be redundant, but Senate Bill 189 changes the process that state agencies use to adopt mediation confidentiality rules. State agency mediation communications have no confidentiality unless they adopt the rules developed by the Attorney General. But under current law, the Attorney General does not have to go through any formal public notice and comment rulemaking when we develop the rules. But then each agency that adopts them has to go through formal rulemaking to do it. So it invites the public in to the process when we've already developed the rules and imposes an administrative burden on the agencies that really serves no purpose. So Senate Bill 189 just proposes to change the rulemaking process to upfront when we're developing the rules and allow the state agencies to just adopt them by reference like they do when adopting other model rules developed by the Attorney General. And we reached out to the Alternative Dispute Resolution section of the bar, and they support the bill and have submitted written testimony. The Oregon Mediation Association also supports the bill, and we understand that they're working on written testimony to submit to the committee, and we're not aware of any opposition, and we don't expect it to have a fiscal. So if you have any questions.
Any questions?
Let's move it.
Senator Thatcher. I should have a quick one. Excuse me. Did I hear you correctly? You said the AG's office doesn't go through a rulemaking process in developing these rules?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, we're not required to by law. We just develop them, but we do okay. Do it.
All right. Thank you.
So I'm assuming this is more or less called an efficiency type of bill where we don't have to go or have agencies go through that formal process that's really has already been vetted, and they do not have flexibility or latitude to have separate individual modeled rules. Mm-hmm. They get what they get, and that's all they're going to get.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, that's correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
It's easy.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to give testimony on Senate Bill 189? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close the public hearing on 189 and go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 189.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 189 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Burdick, would you be our carrier on this one?
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 189. We're not going to go ahead and open up a informational hearing, but we're going to change counsel. And while that's happening, I'll go ahead and introduce that we're going to have an informational hearing. First one will be an overview from the state police. And I'm going to go ahead and open up for the purpose of doing the informational meeting. And Rich Evans is coming forward. Superintendent, thank you very much. I see you got your sidekick in the back. I don't know if you want to bring him up if you'd like. Your choice.
Let's just leave him back there. I think that's fine.
Appropriate spot for him, sir.
All righty. Superintendent, thank you very much for being here today.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. It's an honor and a privilege to represent the men and women of the Oregon State Police, past and present. So a little history lesson with Oregon State Police, and it's kind of interesting how we've come from the very beginning, which began, OSP began operations on August 1st, 1931. It was a consolidation of five state agencies, the State Highway Commission, which is the patrol division as we know today, the Fish and Game Commission, which is our Fish and Wildlife Division as we know today, the State Fire Marshal, who left us and now is back with us, Prohibition Commission, and the Secretary of State Investigation Division. Charles P. Prey at the time had 31 offices, four divisions, and the first report to the legislature, he included that OSP was vigorously working and detected 200 liquor law violations, and that was the news of the day. So we've changed a little bit. One of the things is we look at OSP's history. In 1980, we had a change from the general fund. We went to the general fund from dedicated funding. And staffing levels in 1980 included 641 troopers and sergeants. Mm-hmm. Today, we have 390 all fund troopers and sergeants on patrol today. So we basically have about half of what we had since 1980, and obviously the miles traveled, cars, and population has increased. Today, OSP is a full-service law enforcement agency, very diverse, and I'm going to go into, a lot of folks see the front of what OSP is the patrol division, but we're a lot more than that, and it's become very complex and very complicated. Right now, we have four regions in the state and 42 field offices. So obviously, we've shrunk in our field offices and our blueprint, trying to save money internally, spending it on people instead of locations. We have five bureaus, as I said: administrative services, field operations, gaming and employee services, police services, and public safety services. OSP currently maintains an 11-to-1 supervisor to employee ratio, which is mandated by the legislature. And police, if you read nationally about police ratios and supervision ratios, they talk about 1-to-4 and 1-to-6. If you're in a local area, we have regions of Eastern Oregon where we have one supervisor for, you know, many square miles and very few lots of decisions. They're working 24/7. So I'm going to start with the four operations bureaus. We have the four regions. They're basically what you see out on patrol. They represent the Criminal Patrol and Fish and Wildlife Division. They're responsible for the day-to-day supervision, the use of force, basically the patrol assignments, and all the calls for service. And that's our largest group of folks out there. The Administrative Services Bureau is the fiscal services. We have accounting, budget, payroll, facilities, fleet, procurement, and legislative affairs, which is headed up by Mr. Willis, who's sitting in the back that you are all familiar with. This is where it gets a little complicated and complex. Gaming and employee services, we have the fire marshal. Just over 100 employees, they're responsible for all the fire regulations and codes around the state. We have the lottery security section, who is responsible for making sure that there is no organized crime or corruption in the, basically, the Oregon Megabucks, Powerball, and Lottery Division. We have OSAC, which is the Oregon State Athletic Commission. And when that was put together, it used to be the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and basically that's what it was, boxing and wrestling. Today, now it's cage matches, flying squirrels, people beating on each other, and it's really evolved to a point where today it is not what it was set up in the original legislative intent, and we are working and trying to get that to so our administrative rules and our laws actually reflect the cage matches and the, you know, the battle royals that you see on TV and that type of stuff. We are responsible for providing doctors, ringside care, setting up those events, and it's become very complex, obviously. Tribal gaming is another issue. We have full-time employees that work in tribal gaming that make sure that the fish model is in attacked at the local casinos around the state through their compacts. We have the vendor investigation unit, which is another group of lottery that investigates the vendors who sell the machines to make sure that there's no corruption in that section, which tends to lead us to Las Vegas and across the United States to do those type of investigations. We have, just like every other agency, we have human resources, employee safety, public information officer, which we recently had a retirement there, but that's a 24/7 job for us with what we have going on across the state. We have policy development, risk management, training and recruiting, and the Office of Professional Standards. The Office of Professional Standards is responsible for employee conduct. We had an officer-involved shooting Saturday night in Marion County, and one of my first priorities when I became superintendent was to make sure we had working video systems in every car, and in that shooting where the officers used force, it was videotaped on four separate in-car cameras for review. Nationally, obviously, that's a big issue for folks. They want to see the videotapes, and they don't want to take the officer word, and we've been working very hard on that, and we have our cameras in all of our cars as of today and functional. So that is a public trust issue, and we get a lot of complaints that come in from the public. It's made us more efficient, and the complaints say, well, he said this or he said that. You plop in the videotape, and you watch it, and you can actually see what happened, and it's been very very effective for us. On the flip side of that, we're getting many, many public records requests now for information on videotapes. In fact, we get, since the Ferguson issue and prior to that, we are seeing a substantial increase in public records requests for videotapes, reports, anything to do with police work and public trust. Some of that's from the media and some of it's from citizens, but it's been a substantial increase, and we continue, I believe that trend is going to continue.
Superintendent, regarding that, as a segue, I know the pricing may need to be looked at as to the time and effort it takes. Is your department taking any note as to what their staffing hours are that it's going to take to get those requests and what the delay or time frame is and stuff like that? I'm just wondering if we need to be tracking.
Chair Przanski's members of the committee, yes, we do track that, and we do charge a fee. They'll want something. We'll tell them how long it'll take and what the cost is. But the fact of the matter is there's so many requests. They're hard to keep up with, and I would imagine that the state's probably we're not making money in that endeavor. We're probably losing money in that endeavor as we move forward.
Right. Thank you.
In the Public Safety Services Division, we have Central Records, which several years ago the department had multiple record divisions. Every division basically had their own installment of records in the department. We've moved them all into one place so that we have one-stop shopping for the public if they want any type of report, which leads to the public records requests. We have two dispatch centers across the state, one in the north, one in the south, that dispatch for our troopers, and I believe 11 other law enforcement agencies in the state of Oregon. We also have CJIS, which is the criminal justice ID system, AFIS, which is the automated fingerprint system. When somebody is arrested, those fingerprints are placed into the state and federal system. We have the OUCR, which is the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting that you all see, and which measures whether or not crime is on the increase or decrease. We also maintain the criminal career criminal history files, so if there's an arrest made, we add those to the offender's list and or record so that prosecution, the courts, and all law enforcement has accurate records on whether somebody was arrested or convicted. And then we have the firearm instant check system, which many of you are very well aware of, and that is a very busy unit as of late. We also have technology services. We've tried to improve our officer efficiency with technology, and everything that we have planned in the next 2 to 4 years to increase efficiency within the department is technology related, and it changes and moves very quickly, especially in law enforcement. We have the Police Services Bureau. There's 129 sworn members in the Criminal Investigation Division. Most of those folks are doing major crimes, major person crimes, and they're assigned to teams all around the state of Oregon, where the need is brought to us by the local police chiefs or the sheriffs and the district attorney, and we maintain those folks on teams around the state of Oregon. We have sex offender registration, which continues to grow. We are looking for a technology solution in the near future. We're researching that now. What happened when sex offender and back in the day of early technology is everybody stood up their own technology platform, and those technology platforms cannot communicate with other technology platforms. And now there's technology platforms that are out there that you could plug in Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California in sex offender registration so that you're starting to move nationally to be able to share records. And when somebody moves, one of the biggest issues I hear with public sex offender registration is when somebody moves out of the state, are they notifying the next state, and how are we tracking these predatory individuals as they move around the state? So that is on our radar internally. We have the Drug Enforcement Section, who work around the state on drug teams and task forces, and their major function is high-level cartels and mid-level cartels. They try to dismantle drug trade organizations by identifying those folks in the community. And then we have the arson and explosive section. We investigate arson in conjunction with the fire marshal, and then we respond to many bomb calls throughout the state. You wouldn't believe how many pipe bomb calls, dynamite left in a barn and somebody buys the barn. Our folks are extremely busy, and we're pretty much the sole service outside of the Portland-Eugene area for that, for the entire state. So fish and wildlife is a topic of this legislative session. We have 118 sworn members. We have the three programs, fishery, wildlife, and the aircraft program. We maintain four aircraft in coordination with ODFW for fish and wildlife maintenance. When you hear about the cougars that are tracked or antelope census or herd census, it's our folks that are actually flying those aircraft. We use those in fish and wildlife enforcement and other enforcement activities. As costs, fuel costs have risen in the past, we haven't used them as much, but we'll see if fuel costs stay down, and we'll see how that goes forward. We also have the wildlife program.
Just on your aircraft, have you done any exploration into using drones for those sort of activities?
Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, as you know, the legislature passed the drone initiative last time. It requires a search warrant to do of a lot of issues. And so I believe nationally there's a movement to start to look at maintaining that, but I think we would have some work to do on the statute as it is applied today. There were some discussions about using the drones or using drones, military drones, in the enforcement of the artifacts that were being looted from Southeast Oregon, and as it stands today, we can't do that.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, because we were involved in that, and what we did was a first step, and we knew that. As we go ongoing and try to get to efficiencies, I mean, if you have a cougar sighting, the ability to just, you know, if you're looking at that, that sort of information would probably be helpful to us as we move forward.
Thank you, sir. We have the medical examiner's office headed up by Dr. Gunson, a fabulous doctor. She is a tremendous asset to the state of Oregon. We have the deputy medical examiner that report directly to her. There's three of those folks. And then we have the contracted members around the state that provide that service. Another very busy group of folks that work tirelessly. We have two contract services around the state, the Oregon State University, where we provide contract services, as you are aware of, and then here at the Capitol Mall, where we provide services for the state buildings in this general area here. Patrol services at the division level, we have the tow program. Senate Bill 780 authorizes us to tow vehicles for suspended and drunk drivers. That is obviously a paperwork intensive program. And then we also maintain the non-preference tow list. So if somebody needs a tow on the side of the road, we have a list of certified and inspected tow trucks ready to go that we can call in a list for the general public. We also maintain the drug recognition expert program, which is training officers, basically advanced training in the detection of impaired driving. We have the evidence program, where we maintain our evidence across the state. We are looking at regionalizing our evidence. Instead of having it at locations across the state, we're looking at regionalizing it and having it in a higher security, five locations around the state, easier to maintain, easier to log in category. That's a national trend that we're looking at. We also have our canine program, which we have dogs assigned across the state. They are not biters, they're drug detection dogs. Big difference in the training that those have. We've never had the biting type. We have a reconstruction program, which a lot of times on a fatal motor vehicle crash around the state, our experts are called in, whether it's even in the city or county, to do the total reconstruction and then provide assistance to the district attorney in prosecution or non-prosecution. We also have members on the state radio project, which you're all well aware of, but we maintain some folks that are working through that program to make sure we get to the end and working on interoperability. The last division I'll touch on is forensics. Forensics has really evolved in the last few years. 20 years ago, we had everybody in forensics that was a scientist was trained to do basically everything. That is not the case anymore. I'll give you an example. For DNA, it takes 18 months, a year and a half, just to train somebody before they're able to work on their own in that field. And they, once they're trained in that, they can't go over and do firearm IBIS checks or maybe imply consent or some of the other disciplines. So it's very specialized. And when we lose folks, when we train those folks and we lose them to other jobs, it really puts a difficult, puts us in a difficult place to keep up and maintain, that we don't end up with backlogs in those general areas. We have the toxicology who do the fatal blood draws and DUI and drug arrests, where they're checking to see what's in the blood and urine of the suspected persons. That even carries over to homicide. We maintain the implied consent program, the intoxilizers around the state for all law enforcement. We have the firearms unit who does the IBIS logging on bullets and firearms used in crimes across the state of Oregon. I mentioned DNA. We have chemical trace, digital evidence, and then CODIS. CODIS is the national database that we enter DNA into. There's a lot of misnomers about what can be entered into CODIS, and it's actually a federal standard. It's not a state standard. The state police does not decide what goes into CODIS. There's a lot of push right now for make sure that that the crime lab processes every rape kit that comes to us, and then we put that into CODIS. Even if we processed every rape kit, the federal standards wouldn't allow us to put some of those. They don't meet the criteria to put in the national system. So there's an education process that goes with that. The future of law enforcement in Oregon, I can tell you that partnerships are stronger than they've ever been. The county, city, state, DPSST, and district attorneys work really tirelessly together to try to figure it out. When we went to the rural counties and I met with many of the county commissioners and the public, and when we did our tours, they were always saying, well, I see duplicative services in law enforcement. And the fact of the matter is even if I combine Curry County Sheriff's Office, Gold Beach PD, Port Orford PD, and the state police, we still wouldn't have enough people to do the job in Curry County. And that's the problem. We're not duplicating services. In fact, our schedules are coordinated in those locations, and we do the best we can, but there are calls for service falling through the cracks. You know, we're internally trying to leverage technology. We're working toward a paperless system so that nobody has to handle paper. We started with the citations that are electronic, and we're moving toward reports so that nobody will ever have to handle paper, and it'll be electronic depository. When a report is sent to the district attorney, it'll be electronic. They can send it to the courts electronically, and we cut down on man hours doing to do that. We continue to look for internal savings, and I'll plug our Senate Bill 236, which allows the state police to own real property. One of the things that I set out to do when I was appointed superintendent just under 3 years ago was to find savings within our budget. And I think that there's a public expectation that I do that, and an expectation from you. And if the state police was to own real property, we could save substantial money within the near future and into the future that we could reinvest back into troopers on the road. And so I know there's an informational hearing coming up with that. The one thing that I will close with is that law enforcement in Oregon is moved from proactive to reactive. And what I mean by that is the numbers of law enforcement officers out there on the city, county, state level have dwindled tremendously. Instead of proactively trying to find the drunk drivers, we're waiting for them to crash, and then we're going from one call of service to the next call of service. There are oftentimes in our Salem area command, I listen to it daily, where there's three or four calls stacked up or crashes, and we don't have enough officers to go to all of them. So they're not proactively out there stopping the speeders. And fatal crashes have gone up. And this year in 2015, as I watch, I believe they're going to be even higher in 2015. And in 2014, we also had a spike. And I believe that that's a product of reactive versus proactive law enforcement. So I appreciate your time today, and I'll answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a comment, and thank you for highlighting Curry County, because there's a real problem down there. We don't have 24/7 coverage. And I had a couple years ago, I was talking to a trooper in Gold Beach, and I said, so you get a call out east of the coast, which is cartel country.
Yes, sir.
You know, I said, what do you do? Where's your backup? And he says, there is no backup. And that's a scary situation. So,
yep, it is. Any other questions or comments? So, Superintendent, I had one question just as a follow-up as to when you have a vehicle that's broken down, abandoned, whatever, on the freeway, is it actually a trooper that's posting it, or do we have some type of an agreement with the record services to post notices on the windshields.
So when you drive, Senator Perzianski, members of the committee, when you're driving up and down the highway, you'll see the orange tags that are put on the vehicles. Right now, ODOT and their services will do that, and then our troopers will do that. They have 24 hours to remove the vehicle, and then at that point, we call a tow. But you will see that in the orange tags and the writing with the dates and time are from ODOT and OSB.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's no other questions. Superintendent, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll see if we can work on that other bill.
Thanks.
With that, we're going to go ahead and close this informational hearing on the overview of the state police. We're going to go into the overview of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. So we'll close and open that second one. Eric, thank you very much for being here. And again, if you'd like to have someone join you at the table, feel free to have them.
Great. Thank you. Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Skadlicks. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known by our acronym DPSST. We put together six slides to kind of walk you through the agency. So I know staff has copies of that, and we've also got it up here, and we appreciate the staff working with us on this. Let me start by giving you a framework of our constituency. Everyone you see on this list came to us through legislative action over more than 52 years. The history of our organization started, honestly, as the Board on Police Standards and Training, affecting only city and county law enforcement officers to set standards for professionalism tied into the Kennedy Crime Commission era, where they identified there really wasn't any training standardized across the United States. So the idea was for states to adopt agencies to do that, and that's how our agency was formed. Today, you'll see we serve 23,000 public safety personnel. That includes city, county, state, tribal, and university public safety officers. I'll share with you, based on previous legislation this group has worked on, the University of Oregon has a police department that we've been working with. Portland State University just took action last month to form a police department, and OHSU has a police department. So that's where the new growth has been. I'll also take a second to tell you that with Senate Bill 412, which is going to come up for sunset this session, every tribal law enforcement agency in the state complies with the standards that were set by you. That we administer. So every tribal law enforcement agency complies with Senate Bill 412 and meets the requirements to have all their officers certified by us and under the same professional standards as city, county, state officers. So out of the 11,000 criminal justice, that's parole and probation, that's law enforcement, and that is corrections, both state and county, and also city. We do have a number of city jails, Springfield being the largest, but also Junction City, Florence have municipal jails, and those people are under our standards for corrections officer training. On the fire service side, we serve 14,000 firefighters, 80% of which are volunteer, and we have a voluntary certification system for them, but more than 90% of the fire service participates in that system with us. Also, during previous legislative action, Senate Bill 1528 added OLCC inspectors and investigators to our requirement for certification and training standards. We are working with that group right now. That has not taken place yet, so we're working with them on it. Obviously, with the changes with marijuana coming up, there'll probably be some discussion about how that's going to work with us and what their duties are going to be. But right now, they are not police officers. They do not have the same powers of a full-time officer, and we're setting up a separate training track and certification track just for OLCC inspectors and investigators. Then the other thing I'll mention, and it's a fund that we're honored to manage, but we hope it never needs to be used, and that is the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. Through legislative action, a fund was created to allow us to administer a death benefit to officers, firefighters killed in a line of duty, and also assistance for officers, firefighters permanently disabled in a line of duty due to a single act. We're very, very honored to administer that fund with a board that is set up in statute. We have had dozens of people in that system over the years that tragically lost their spouses in the line of duty, but I wanted to take a second to mention that. Then the next group that we serve are private security and private investigators. There's 18,500 of those people, and those are individuals that provide security services at a large event. It could be crowd management. It could be at a bar. It could be at a corporate facility. But all those people are required to be licensed by DPSST and uphold professional standards. And then finally, under our constituency are 55 polygraph examiners. By state statute, they're required to be licensed by the state and complete tests to able to say that they are a polygraph examiner. So we work with that constituency, and they actually have a group that governs their own standards that works with us through the administrative rule process. The next chart is a little busy, but it kind of shows how we're organized. And the example that I would use is very similar to the Ways and Means process here at the legislature. We have 24 members of the board that are approved by the governor with Senate confirmation. They represent the different constituents or stakeholder groups that we represent. Out of that 24, six of those members are the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board we talked about. And as you see, we break up into five policy committees that are set up in statute, and that would be very similar to how Ways and Means breaks up. This is where the rubber meets the road for these disciplines. So any issue involving law enforcement goes to the Police Policy Committee. Anything regarding corrections goes to that committee, et cetera, et cetera. And that is really where the initial work starts with any standards case that we're going to deal with, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then you'll also see that the department serves the board, but also administers the Polygraph Committee and the Governor's Medal of Honor Commission that was created a few years ago to honor officers that have gone above and beyond that deserve recognition, and that's a separate commission that we have. So this is internally very much like Superintendent Evans' discussion, how we're structured as an organization. We work in a four-division model. We have two externally-facing divisions, two internally-facing divisions. Professional standards, and we'll talk about that next, deals with the licensure, the certification, the loss of licensure and certification. The facilities and information technology takes care of our campus. As many of you know, you've come out to visit us. We have a fortunate ability to have a campus here in Salem, 235 acres. More than 360,000 square feet, where we provide all the basic training for newly hired officers in a state, regardless of the agency they work for in law enforcement. So they have to come to the academy, and we'd be glad to share the facility anytime you folks want to come out. And then the business side of our shop basically makes sure people get paid. We're following state policies, procedures for all of our procurements, and also our network services are up and running. And then the other large division that we have is the training division, which is the provider of training. We mentioned the campus, and we'll talk more about the training we offer, but we also do offer external training off campus, primarily for regional advanced law enforcement training, where we reach about 15,000 students a year. And then our fire training program is 90% off campus, because local fire departments honestly just can't leave town to go to training. We take training to them, and that is especially true with volunteer fire departments, where those people have a full-time job and provide service to their community as a volunteer, so their time is limited. So a lot of our fire training is done at nights and on weekends. Usually at local fire departments, we do regional training, and that program reaches about 15,000 students a year with fire service training. We also do, and it ties into both the superintendent and Aaron's comments, we manage the HIDTA training program, which comes through Department of Justice, and that specialized training we deliver to officers working in the HIDTA regions through a federal grant. And then we also have a state DOT grant, Department of Transportation, for traffic safety law enforcement training. They fund a full-time position at our agency that focuses on DUI training, drugs that impair driving, and seatbelt enforcement training classes. So moving to the next slide is what we call our shared stewardship. What does the board do? What does the department do? This is laid out in statute. The board sets standards for training. They set standards for employment. The board addresses revocation and denial issues. The board has to look at waivers. The board sets policy. It helps with strategic planning, guidance, and it represents the constituents. That's how 41,000 people really have a voice in the process that we use. The department, we staff, obviously, the board and committees. We carry out their direction. We work with the advisory committees. We are the ones that uphold compliance with the standards that the board sets. We provide training, as we talked about. We operate the academy, and we also bring issues forward to the board and to the committee. So the national discussion that's happening on law enforcement accountability, those type of things, those are discussions that we'll bring forward to the board and have discussions at those meetings about those issues. One of the things that we always say is that staff doesn't make a decision who or who we don't move forward to certify or decertify. Those are decisions made by the board. So any rule change being made has to go to the board. Our budget goes to the board. Any legislative concept goes to the board. So that's where our stakeholders have a fingerprint on the work. And it's a pretty successful process, even though I know it looks complicated on paper. It works pretty well for us. For professional standards, and later today you'll have two bills on your agenda dealing with this, but we call it cradle to grave, especially in our criminal justice program, and that is that the board sets a standard for what an officer has to do to be employed in the industry as a state minimum, and then we have what's required to be certified, and then we have what's required to maintain that certification. So that continues throughout a person's career in the criminal justice family. We also address revocation on denial. These are issues that usually make the paper. It involves officers' misconduct. I will tell you that on an annual basis, we decertify approximately 100 criminal justice officers in the state. So as you hear discussions nationally on police accountability, we do have a system that is very robust, and we're very proud of it because other states don't even decertify officers. So we have a system with our constituents that not only are officers held accountable, but they also do face sanctions if they do something that's inappropriate. So out of those 100 a year, the big three continues to be drug, sex, money. Unfortunately, bad decisions made by officers. Social media is obviously one of the issues now that's used behind the scenes is how people work in those environments inappropriately. So we address that. And then also, if an officer is decertified, we enter him into a national database, which is a pointer system amongst the state certification bodies for law enforcement. But it allows us to prevent bad officers from going to other states and getting jobs. And 31 states currently participate in that system. By statute, our agency also allows a person to put their name on the ballot to be a sheriff. We have to vet them to make sure they're going to meet the standard to be hired. I'll share with you a small story that the oldest graduate just finished the academy at 72 years of age, which is Sheriff Frank Scraw from Klamath County. Sheriff Scraw had a great career in Los Angeles with the police department for a number of years, decided to move to Klamath, had a ranch, was happy for 20 years. His neighbor asked him to be sheriff. He ran for sheriff, has been out so long he had to come back to basic, and he did successfully complete the class, and he wasn't at the end of the class. So we're pretty excited about that. We also have, through state statute, the authority and responsibility to audit Department of Corrections training. Some of you know that have been here for a number of years that DOC used to be part of our academy structure. A number of years they went in-house with their training, but the agreement was that we would audit those training programs to make sure they're meeting state standards, the testing meets state standards. And I'm very pleased to tell you that they do meet and exceed that state standard, and we work with them daily. Through state statute, we also allow federal officers arrest powers under Oregon statute. This came forward many years ago through the Postal Inspection Service that brought up an issue where they were seeing things that were crimes but not federal crimes, and they had no way to bring those issues forward. So as a result of legislative action, we do have the authority now, once they complete training on the state statutes they can enforce, that they have authority to make arrests for that. So moving next to criminal justice training, and this is a lot of what we do. We provide 16 weeks of basic training for newly hired officers. We provide 6 weeks of training for corrections officers. We provide 5 weeks for parole and probation officers, and if the county arms those officers, they come back for an additional week of training. Not every parole and probation officer in the state is armed. Not every parole and probation agency in the state chooses to carry weapons, so that's something that we bifurcated so that we address those that do, and we have a vehicle for those that don't. For people that answer the 911 calls and provide emergency medical dispatch services, they attend 3 weeks of training at the academy. We also have a 2-week supervision class and a 2-week middle management class that was restored last session through $3,194 reinvestment dollars. That's been very well received, and we have been asked to give testimony at the 21st Century Presidential Commission on what we're doing there, and that gets into the discussion of police legitimacy, the accountability, the interaction with communities. So we're pretty excited about what we're doing there in partnership with our constituents. And then finally, we do have a career officer development courses for officers coming from other states to Oregon with certification. We need to make sure that they understand Oregon statutes. It's different than most other states, as are theirs. So they come to us for 2 weeks where we basically give them an update on Oregon law, civil liability issues, and then send them out to their agencies because they already know how to make an arrest. They know how to stop a car, but they need to know Oregon criminal code, Oregon motor vehicle code. In closing, I would say that we would invite all of you out if you want to come and see the facility. We've worked with staff. If there's discussions that you want to have on use of force issues and go through the simulators and get scenarios, we're glad to do that. We also, I mentioned the tribal sunset will be in front of you this year. We're also working with state police, the chiefs and sheriffs and the DAs in the technology discussions, body cameras, in-car video, the electronic surveillance vehicles that are out there. So we're a partner because everything does tie into training at some point. So we've been very active in those discussions. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions you have and appreciate your time.
All right. questions? Senator Burdick.
There's been a trend toward higher education institutions moving toward their own security systems, and they require training at DPSST for their officers. Do you have any special programs for those types of situations? I know there's been concerns at OHSU about dealing with mentally ill, and how are you dealing with that new kind of branch of business?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, our system is fairly unique in the state of Oregon. So I mentioned that a new officer, regardless of what agency they work with, city, county, tribe, university, state trooper, is going to come to us for 16 weeks in a blended class. They're going to learn what we call the core program. But our program doesn't stop when they graduate the academy. It continues when they go to their employing agency. And what they're required to do is complete a field training manual on a job with their coach. And what that does is that allows the training to continue with the local resources, the local culture, the local policies and procedures. So each community, and I would say a university is a city within a city. For example, at Portland State, there's thousands of students there every day, staff, faculty, guests. So they would learn the policies, procedures, the customs, the culture of that agency, and how they integrate with that community on campus. We've done a very good job with University of Oregon, OHSU. They have addressed and had a lot of meetings on campus with the not only faculty, but also students to understand what that culture should look like. And I know from the discussions we've had with Director Zerzan in Portland State, they want to do the same thing. So really, we provide the core at the academy, but that training finishes up locally with that local agency custom flavor and a lot of the different issues that officers need to know to work in that community.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And you have a what is your role as that ancillary training takes place?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick. We require that the field training manual be completed before certification be issued. So to use an element of a stopwatch, when an officer is hired, they have 18 months from date of hire to become state certified. So that means getting into the academy for 16 weeks and then finishing the field training program. In some cases, the field training manual and the field training program may take 6 to 9 months, depending on the complexity of that agency. So if I were a new officer at an agency, and let's say you all work there, Senator Gelser may have me for the first 30 days, you may have me for the next 30 days, Chair Przanski may have me for the next 30 days, and each of us are providing an element of that training and looking at certain things. Not only the learning that I'm picking up the local issues, but also how I'm applying those issues. And not everybody makes it through field training. So not everybody makes it through the academy. Not everybody makes it through the field training program, and not everybody makes it to 18 months. Because after we're done, you're done with me as a coach. Now I'm going to work by myself, but you're going to watch how I do to see if I'm doing the right thing. So I know the discussions we've had with the universities, and I guess I'll try to correct some of the things in the paper. They're saying they're armed security officers. That's not the discussion taking place at University of Oregon or Portland State. They'll be armed police officers, fully functional police officers, just like a state trooper, just like a county deputy, just like a Portland police officer, and they'll be under the same standards as everybody else. So in some ways, some of the news articles have been misleading because they will be fully functional law enforcement officers.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, I had two questions, Eric.
Yes.
On the fire service, when you're describing it and going out and doing trainings in the rural areas, I know that some of the facilities of the larger cities have have the capacity of doing regional training. Do we use some type of contracting or for that?
Chair Przanski, I smile because we don't contract. We barter. We do utilize our regional training facilities where in some cases we'll bring a class to the facility. We don't charge for any of the fire training classes we offer. That's funded through fire insurance premium tax. But we have great agreements with City of Portland, with City of Eugene, with Medford, Jackson County Fire District Number 3, Coos Bay, Salem, and Tualatin Valley. So they have facilities that they open up not only to us but to their neighbors to come in. And the same thing happens. We have a number of mobile props. We have a 53-foot tractor trailer that's a burn simulator that's a building on fire. We just have purchased 2 roof ventilation props, which allow us to set roofs up on a trailer where they can learn how to ventilate. We have the Code 3 driver training program with a skid truck, which we take regionally. So we do a lot of partnerships, a lot of agreements, and we have never paid for any venue that we've used because people want us there. And it just shows the partnership with the public safety agencies and the city, county, state partners.
last question is on the career officers. Understand the 2 week as to this would be someone that's a lateral hire that's active in the department they're leaving and they're coming in, as I'm assuming.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, there's two ways that people come to career officer development. The statute allows the board to set the standards. The standard that the board set is that if you leave the profession in Oregon from 0 to 2.5 years, you come back right away. You're fine. If you're 2.5 to 5 years, you come to the 2 week refresher class. If you're out for more than 5 years, you come back to basic. So that's officers in state that decide to do something else, they decide to come back to law enforcement, corrections, parole, probation. On the other side, we have officers coming to Oregon from other states. We, through staff analysis, and Lindsay Hale and Kristen Hibberts are here today with me, their section looks at, does the training that they receive equal the basic that we provide in our state? And if it does, we give them a reciprocity, but they have to come through the 2 week career officer development class to learn our state statutes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, then we're going to go ahead and close the overview on DPSST, informational hearing. And I think we're ready to go ahead and have our public hearing on Senate Bill 238. So we'll open it up. Laura, can you give us the overview?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238 comes to us at the request of Governor Kitzhaber for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. There is no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact. We're not looking at any amendments. Under current Oregon law, public safety agencies must provide DPSST with personnel records of present or past employees for the purpose of investigation. The statute does not currently include private safety agents, however. Senate Bill 238 includes private safety agencies in the requirements of ORS 181.675, which deals with disclosure of information of public safety officers. The bill also authorizes the director of DPSST to apply for a court order to compel compliance with the personnel record request, whether it is for a private agency or a public agency. Senate Bill 238 also clarifies that the internal use of a public safety officer's photograph is permitted without the written consent of that officer or their employer.
All right, thank you. And it looks like we have Lindsay Hale. Lindsay?
Chair, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Director of Professional Standards at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. As indicated by Ms. Hansel and in the written testimony provided, I'll keep this very short. Current law requires public safety agencies provide DPSST access to personnel records if DPSST requests access due to an investigation being conducted relating to a current, former, or future public safety officer's qualifications to be employed, trained, or certified. Senate Bill 238 would allow the director to request a court order from the court having jurisdiction compelling compliance with that requirement on the rare occasion that an agency refuses to grant access to personnel records. Also, the bill does expand the requirement to private safety agencies who are employing certified public safety officers as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. So it sounds to me basically what this would be is an opportunity for the director to actually, let's say, insist through a court order in the sense of petition the court where an agency for some unknown reason is not willing to voluntarily turn those records over?
That's correct, Chair.
Any questions? Senator Thatcher.
I guess just real quick, just give me a sentence of why, what's prompting this?
It is a very rare occasion, but it has happened previously where an agency has not been so willing to share that information with our professional standards folks doing an investigation.
And basically, from my perspective, this is our oversight where we think we need to be able to take corrective actions, whatever those actions may be. And if we have a department for whatever reason, maybe out of embarrassment or whatever, doesn't want this to come out, we have the checks and balances by having this ability, and it is a due process scenario going through the courts. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? With that, I'm going to go ahead and let me just ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 238. Not seeing anyone come forward, we close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 238.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 238 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 238 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, discussions, comments? Not seeing any. Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any. So ordered. And that bill passes. And Senator Cruz, if you'll be our carrier on 238. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill, or excuse me, the work session on Senate Bill 238, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 239. Laura.
Yes, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. This bill, Senate Bill 239, also comes at the request of Governor Kitzhaber for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. We're not looking at any amendments. So currently in Oregon, there's about 1,300 reserve officers. And current Oregon law refers to certified reserve officers. However, there is not currently a mechanism to certify officers, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that. Senate Bill 239 explicitly adds then reserve officers to the definitions of public safety personnel and public safety officer so that OSR language can include reference to both the certified officers and reserve officers. Additionally, Senate Bill 239 adds reserve officers to the definition of commissioned, as well as the a minimum employment age requirement of 21 years of age. And then the last thing it does is it removes reserve officers from the current statutory exemption for minimum standards and minimum training.
And thank you. And Lindsay, I think you're going to be presenting as well.
Yes, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Again, Lindsay Hale with DPSST for the record. As indicated in the written testimony provided, Senate Bill 239 is before you on behalf of the board of. I'm sorry, it's on my brain.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. And we're going to get there this session, I guarantee you.
Senate Bill 239 is before you on behalf of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. It recently came to their attention that the lack of jurisdiction of the board and the department to require agencies conduct background checks on officers prior to uniforming them and arming them as non-certified sworn reserve police officers in the state. Just to make the distinction, the board does have jurisdiction over certified reserve officers. However, that certified reserve officer program has never been funded. So of the hundreds of reserve officers being utilized in the state, none of them are currently trained or certified by DPSST at this time. Senate Bill 239 adds reserve officers to the definition of public safety officer and public safety personnel, thereby giving the board the authority to set and enforce minimum standards. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz.
We set up a category to refuse to fund it, and so we weren't able to catch what we were after, and this is just fixing that.
Unfortunately, without the funding, this gives us the oversight.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
But
just for the record that, as much as we'd like to have that, and I'm not sure if you have enough time in the day or the weeks that you've already have charted out for all the other endeavors that you're in, but this will, in fact, from my expectation, give that oversight once again so that we have that checks and balances.
Yep.
Other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This just applies to the DPSST functions for these definitions. Is that correct, or does it go into other statutes? And it doesn't put them on a par with sworn officers.
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Burdick, no, it does not.
Thank you.
Yeah, it'll be at least these definitions that will be within our state statutes, but there is a separate section or group of statutes dealing with reserves as compared to commissioned certified officers.
Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Okay.
If I could just provide some very quick clarification on that. The way that the statute is drafted, the bill is drafted, it would give the board the authority to set minimum standards relating to reserve officers as they have the authority to do for other law enforcement officers.
Yeah. And so, Senator Gelser?
Yes. So this would require that all reserve officers go through the same background check, child welfare check, stalking order, domestic violence check as every other sworn officer before they're badged and armed?
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Gelser, it would give the board the authority to write those rules to make them comply with those same standards, yes.
And follow up?
Yes.
Would that be retroactive to those that are already sworn, or is that to be determined by the board?
I believe that's to be determined.
And Chair Pruszynski, Senator Gelser, in honesty, 8% of the agencies are already using the same standard for reserve as a full-time officer. One of the things that really sparked this discussion to come forward to our Police Policy Committee or board is we're working a revocation case on a sworn officer full-time, and the question came up about the reserve officer that was included in the discussions. Superintendent Evans brought up concern he had with a very minimal background, especially accessing computerized criminal history issues and all that. So the board asked that we tighten up this issue and make sure that those reserves are meeting the same standard across the board so we get to 100%, not 98%.
Thank you. And I think the other part is it will set that threshold so where we're not having, unfortunately, the funding to actually put them through the state DPSST, if an agency is going to bring someone on as a reserve, they're going to have these, again, threshold minimum standards with whatever qualifications the rules provide for. Any other comments or questions? I'm going to go ahead and first ask if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 239. Not seeing that, we'll close the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 239.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry the bill, and guess what? It's 9:59, and we're adjourned till tomorrow at 8:30.
Hey, we're getting warm.